You may not know it, but meditation and mindfulness are hot topics today. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of meditation centers all across the U.S. Meditation and yoga are being taught in many schools, and PBS has just broadcast a new two-hour film by David Gruben called The Buddha. On iTunes, you can find over 150 apps for meditation. On Amazon.com, if you type in mindfulness, you get about 2,000 results. Buddhism gets 20,000. Meditation, over 44,000. Clearly, people are receptive to and fascinated by meditation and mindfulness. But it's much more than a popular fad. Meditation is getting major attention and support in medical circles as well. The Mayo Clinic claims that spending even a few minutes in meditation can restore calm and inner peace. In a 2009 study of 200 African-American men with heart problems, the American Heart Association found that practicing TM resulted in a 43% reduction in mortality. And the National Institute of Health has invested millions to look into how effective various types of meditation can, how effective they can be in helping reduce health risks. But what is meditation really? How does it work and why? How has it changed over the thousands of years since it began? To answer those and other related questions, I'm talking to Josh Bartok, Zen priest, author of several books on meditation, and contributor to over 100 books on meditation and mindfulness for Wisdom Publications, where he's a senior editor. One of the many reasons that I've chosen Josh for this topic is that his books are very clearly intended for an audience beyond the Buddhist community, and what we're going to be focusing on today, the general benefits of meditation and mindfulness as he sees them. Josh, first of all, thank you very much for granting this interview.
My pleasure.
I'm very excited to be here. So there's a great community of thoughtful people who contribute to my Facebook page, and they send in a lot of questions for me to ask you. But before we get to those, let's start with a very basic one. Why are you interested in giving an interview about meditation and mindfulness?
This stuff matters. This stuff contributes to our well-being and our being able to skillfully and choicefully navigate our lives and really with more intentionality, more effectively be the person we mean to be, to respond to situations with not just intelligence, but kindness, skillfulness, and usefulness.
So this is great because your response, what I'm hearing, and tell me if I'm right, is that a practice of meditation and mindfulness, which turns one inward, also affects the way one acts in an outward fashion.
That's exactly right, and in an important way. The practice we do on the cushion, the formal meditation practice, is it's essentially like drilling in a batting cage or rehearsing a piece of music over and over and over again. We are practicing a fundamental skill in the situation that is most easy, most simplified, in a quiet space with other people in endeavoring in the same way we are, special cushions to support our body in a particular way, and perhaps chants or rituals to remind us of the practice we're engaged in, with time set aside to just practice this one thing. And at its base, it is recognizing thoughts that arise and unhooking from their habitual power and returning our attention back to the breath, back to the, whatever it is that we're meditating on, back to the posture, back to the basic counting, for instance, of counting your breath, the basic practice of counting your breath. And we practice this one essentially skill, noticing, unhooking, and returning back over and over and over again. And so, contrary to what a lot of people think, meditation isn't actually about trying to clear the mind, empty the mind, or still the mind. And it isn't about trying to feel wiser or more compassionate or more blissed out. All of those things may happen, but in an important way, they are side effects, byproducts of this practice of noticing what's arising for us, unhooking from it, and returning. And we practice in the batting cage of the meditation hall so that in the much more challenging crucible of our real lives, then when anger comes up for us or fear, instead of then just going on automatic pilot and acting out angrily, we're able to notice, fear has arisen in this moment. Okay, so who do I mean to be? what's useful, what's skillful, what's kind. So this practice really is a support for the real life practice of your everyday and every moment life.
This is so interesting because a number of neuroscientists recently studying our reaction time and decision-making process have identified a process very similar to what you're talking about, where the question of free will is still up for grabs, but there are several neuroscientists who are now discovering that we have the ability of free won't, where we recognize, as you say, the impulse to react negatively or perhaps impulsively in a way that's destructive to us, and we do have a window of time within which we can suppress that desire and make a perhaps more rational or a decision more in our own self-interest.
So, in a way, that's exactly right. I would just add the caveat that that it isn't that we suppress desires. We don't. Meditation in the Buddhist tradition is never about causing stuff not to arise. Grasping, aversion, the stories we tell ourselves, the judgments we make, all of that is part of the birthright of being human. And Zen practice, for instance, is not about getting rid of any part of ourselves. In fact, what it's about is expanding, growing, and pushing beyond the narrow definitions of who we are and what we have to do. And so, the practice of meditation in that neuroscience example you gave, the practice of meditation lengthens that window in which we can make that choice. First, what it does is it lets us notice that window, even if in the beginning we notice the window and then we notice, boy, I sure missed that window. And then gradually we start to have more and more spaciousness, more and more space to respond or not respond, to see our anger or reactivity just as reactivity and not as a categorical imperative the way we normally interpret everything that comes into our mind. And all of this practice comes, so we start with the basic discipline of stillness, and that's what lets us engage that practice. Because the first thing that we encounter, anybody encounters when they sit in meditation, is that it doesn't feel exactly perfectly right, because we're human beings, and that's pretty much the way we go through our lives. And ordinarily, sitting in our office on a desk chair or something, we're always shifting around trying to get the exact right position, and you can't. You can't. And even if you could in another moment, then it passes away. And even if you could get it and hold it, there's definitely going to come a point in our lives, whether through sickness, old age, car accident or something, when the perfectly comfortable, optimal position of body is not available to us at all. And so Zen practice is an opportunity to, instead of trying to fix that external circumstance, whether or not our body is comfortable, we can start to change our relationship to this story of discomfort. So when the mind is screaming, you have to move, you have to scratch your nose right now, you have to get up because your leg's falling asleep. And ordinarily, we just then scratch our nose or we move or we get up. But in meditation, when we don't do that, we start to learn something very important about all of the things that our mind's screaming. When our mind says, you have to do it, and then we don't, then we start to loosen the shackles between our own, that our own thoughts kind of hold us to. And we start to get a beginning taste of what it might mean to live skillfully in our life with freedom and choicefulness.
I'm really interested in your discussion. You mentioned Zen practice, of course, and you're grounding everything that you're saying in the Zen tradition. But I was so interested to read in the interview you gave with Sweeping Zen website. Of course, you are a Zen priest, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you've been ordained, and you've studied Zen practice and Zen meditation and Zen history extensively. And yet I was really interested to read in the interview that you said Zen beliefs, and religious institutions in general are, quote, not necessary for us to be present to our life exactly as it is, that ability to experience the perfection of this moment just as it is. So could you explain the apparent contradiction of being a person who's devoted many years of his life to religious study and practice, and yet you're saying you don't need necessarily to be religious in order to get that benefit?
Sure. So the simplest formulation of it is that none of these things, none of these religious institutions, none of the outward forms of Buddhism or Zen are necessary for us to find and connect to that life. But what the experience of millions of people over hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years has shown is that these tools are in fact sufficient to help us find what those things might be and to help us develop our own skillfulness in that practice of being present, in that practice of unhooking from our grasping, aversion, and storytelling. And the forms, all of the forms of Zen, the liturgical forms, the chanting, the encounters with a teacher, the discipline of stillness, the practice of bringing your hands together palm to palm in a gesture called gassho, all of these things are practices that experience of human beings have shown are actually useful. And there is a tendency as Buddhism has come to the West and especially in America, where we're really trying to make it our own thing, to throw a little bit too much of the baby out with the bathwater. And so while it is entirely possible for people to wake up to this reality by themselves without any of these tools, that is, in fact, very, very rare. And with these tools, in fact, it becomes much more common. And these are tools that generations of teachers in the Zen tradition, for instance, are trained in presenting, wielding, using, guiding other people in, including pointing out pitfalls and traps and all of the kind of common ways and games that our minds kind of will play on us, the ways that we can fall into pits and get trapped in our own stories.
Well, let's talk about that. I'm very interested to hear your West meets Eastern ideas, because, of course, I know many people who are in a state now of constant stimulation and sometimes self-entertainment. While they're reading, they're thinking of the video they could be watching. While they're watching the video, they're seeing ads for products they could be buying. While they're consuming those products, they may be thinking of people to tell about them. So I'm interested in two quotes that I found in your book, Daily Wisdom. And in one, it says, mindfulness is never boring, first, which, you know, I find fascinating. And the second one says, it is difficult to imagine anything more inherently boring than sitting still for an hour with nothing to do but feel the air going in and out of your nose. You are going to run into boredom repeatedly in your meditation. Everybody does. Boredom is a mental state and should be treated as such. So I love the fact that you put both of those in your book. How do you explain the contradiction or the coexistence of a practice that is ostensibly boring and yet is never boring?
Yeah, so that's really keenly identified on your part. And I don't actually think it's a contradiction. So there's a way in which there's a way in which if we really fully turn our attention, fully turn our whole heart toward anything, we can really come to appreciate it as really luminously itself. We can really come to appreciate the specifics of it, whatever it is, the Buddhist word is thusness, it being exactly as it is. And one of the recitations that we do says that whenever we look deeply into the real form of the universe, everything reveals this mysterious truth, and things can't help but shine with this light. And we can really kind of lovingly, open-heartedly, open-handedly receive even what we imagine are negative states, like boredom, like grief, like anxiety or fear, and we can spaciously hold those in our heart in an intimate fashion that that lets us really appreciate even things that we imagine are only negative.
So are you saying that some boredom, just to take that example, exploring, recognizing, acknowledging our own boredom can be a way of being with ourselves or better understanding the world?
That's right. That's right. But in the case of boredom, which is a little bit of a special case, what's actually going on if when boredom comes up for meditation, boredom isn't a self-existent thing. If you look closely and really see what that thing that you are interpreting as boredom is, it's actually composed of a variety of mental formations like thoughts, a variety of psychological resonances, and also a kind of chatter that we're telling ourselves. So we find ourselves going, man, this is so boring. I really hate this. What was I thinking sitting down for 25 minutes of meditation? Jesus, I can't wait to get outside and run around and maybe get a hamburger later. That's going to be good. But this is... So all of those are stories that we're telling ourselves. There is no self-existent boredom going on. There's the thought, boy, I'm so bored. There's the other subsequent thoughts about it. And then there's our grasping onto those thoughts and getting pulled along, like by a Great Dane, you know, down the sidewalk. And when we see that process, we engage even boredom exactly the way we engage anything else that captures our attention, anything else that arises for us during meditation. And we unhook from it. We again bring our attention back to the breath, back to the posture, back to one. And then the mind again moves into stories about boredom, or maybe they moves into something else. And whenever we notice that our attention is anywhere other than where we've intended to put it, we notice that, we unhook from that story, come back to the breath, back to the posture, back to one. Even if it's just for a microsecond. And it's actually that unhooking and returning that strengthens the muscle, builds the strength of us to be able to do that in the more challenging circumstances of our lives. And engaging it with the boredom of meditation is an important way, really safe, because it's so trivial. It's just the story we're telling ourselves about this moment. And so when we can practice in safety with this fairly irrelevant fact of whether we're bored or not in this moment, then we're developing a skill that we can use in times of excruciating physical pain or of really deep emotional grief. And then having honed our skill by engaging boredom in this way, we have a skill set to apply to the much more challenging things elsewhere.
So to go back to two of your earlier analogies, meditating through the boredom or anxiety or frustration or anger or pain is being in the batter's box and striking out and hitting and all of those things, so that when you're in the much higher pressure situation of a quote-unquote real game,
that's right,
you are better able to engage. So it's really practice for life. as you're saying.
That's exactly right. And I would just clarify, because I work with words professionally, I would say not meditating through, but meditating with, because it isn't actually a barrier that you need to pass through to get somewhere else. It is the thing itself. It's the whole expression of this moment of your very precious singular life.
So the practice can be as important as whatever it is you're practicing for.
That's right. And ultimately, more so.
Okay, so this is great. This leads me to the question of sort of seeking deeper meaning. So Daniel Pink, who's the author of a great new book called A Whole New Mind, has written, "We live in an age of breathtaking material plenty. That has freed hundreds of millions of people from day-to-day struggles and liberated us to pursue more significant desires such as purpose, transcendence, and spiritual fulfillment." So how do you think meditation can play a role in people's search for those deeper, more meaningful values?
Mm-hmm. So all of those things are indeed part of the spiritual and do arise, and they are almost always the kinds of things that bring us to any spiritual practice in the first place. And yet, to come for all of these lofty, very great sounding things, and all you find is your own damn mind, right here in this moment on the cushion. I came for bliss. I came for enlightenment. I came for fulfillment. My God, I just got knees and backache and tedium. Mm-hmm. And there is no other path but through the path of our lives. But through encountering those things and practicing with the discomfort in the body, with the unease in the mind, with our disappointment about not having been magically transformed into whatever we imagine a spiritual practitioner ought to be, or an enlightened being ought to be, or a good Zen student ought to be, we've just got ourselves. But through really practicing with ourselves and receiving our lives moment to moment, and really practicing with our disappointment, our brokenheartedness, our disillusionment, that is actually the path to spiritual fulfillment, to wisdom, to compassion for the suffering of beings everywhere.
So this is it, here and now. Awareness of the moment, awareness of everything happening in the moment, including the things that you just wish weren't there, that is very much the state that we are seeking.
That's right. That's right. Which isn't to say that there aren't special meditation states that arise. It isn't to say that you won't have moments of light or loftiness or peace or bliss or any of the rest. But those things are side effects and byproducts of engaging our life just as it is. And in a way, that's a huge relief, because there are these special states of mind that human beings can get into for limited periods of time where everything just feels so wonderful. But they pass. And this is something that the Buddha himself discovered 2,500 years ago. He actually was extremely adept at getting into these heaven realms, these really vast, formless states of mind where all suffering ceased. But then what he always noticed is that state of mind passed, and there he was back in his life. And that sent him, that is what kind of became the starting place for all Buddhism. And what we can get in touch with through this practicing, through this practice of encountering our life just as it is, encountering our mind just as it is, encountering our ass and our knees just as it is we can get in touch with a fundamental okayness, a fundamental perfection that actually has nothing to do with anything as trivial as the mere state of our body, mind, psyche, job, or any of the rest of it. And it isn't dependent on those circumstances.
So it's a practice leading to unhooking as much from the blissful state as it is from the nightmare state.
That's exactly right. And the Buddhist way of saying it is it's a practice of not unhooking from the heavenly states as well as from the hell realms.
Okay.
All of which are places that we as human beings are capable of getting into.
All right, well, now that's a perfect time to segue to questions about practice itself, about the actual practice of meditation. So now that you've identified a lot of things that meditation is and isn't and can and can't do, I want to talk a little bit about some questions that some of my contributors had about the nuts and bolts of meditation that they're very curious about. So first, how do people start? You have written and contributed to books. You teach classes on meditation. We know that there are recordings, there are CDs, there are practices one can do by oneself. And for a lot of the people that have been sending in questions for me, they're just really unsure of where or how to start.
Sure.
What would you say to people who are curious about a positive first step?
So the first thing is that the word meditation actually, I mean, as your numbers at the beginning of the podcast said, it refers to so many things, so many different practices, and it can be used in so many different ways that it actually doesn't really mean anything. So there is no such thing as generically meditating.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to generically meditate, you're probably just playing another kind of game with your mind. And so what I teach is a practice, the practice of Zazen, which is meditation as practiced by the Zen school. And the place to start is with the very simple practice of counting your breath. Breathing in, you count silently one, out two, in three, so on up to 10. When you get to 10, you start over at one. But it doesn't actually matter if you get to 10. It doesn't actually matter if you get to two. The power of this practice comes from noticing you are doing anything other than what you've intended to do. Sit here and count your breath. And when you notice your mind is anywhere else at all, you unhook, come back to grounding yourself in the body, back to the breath, back to one, over and over and over again. And that is the place where the Zen tradition encourages people to start with meditation. And a very excellent introduction to this practice is called Zen Meditation in Plain English. And it's really vitally important to seek out a community, to seek out a teacher, not because a teacher has anything special to give you, has any magical formula or any secret practice or secret powers, but because it's so easy and the traps we can fall into are so subtle that without the support of a teacher and a community, experience of human beings has shown it's very, very hard. But still, practice is something that you have to do yourself, and you can't just go and like get it from a group or from a community. And ultimately, you have to find a way to practice in your life. And the thing about practicing in your life is that longer is not better. It isn't the case that you have to practice 45 minutes a day, every day, or you're not really doing it. Whatever you can do is worth doing. And so even if that's 5 minutes, even if it's 2 minutes, practicing regularly is the place to start. And what's crucial in practicing regularly is to decide beforehand how long you're going to sit, and commit to sitting that long no matter what. So don't just sit for, oh, you know, 5, maybe 10 minutes until you get antsy and decide you got something else to do, because that isn't actually taking advantage of the practice. Commit beforehand that you're going to sit for 3 minutes. Set a timer, do that. And then if the next day, and come hell or high water, you keep your butt on that seat for 3 minutes. And then come the next day, if you want to expand it to 4 minutes or 5 minutes, feel free to do that. Doing it a little bit each day, checking in with your body and mind in that fashion each day is far more important than going on meditation binges where you do a retreat once every 4 years, or you practice for 2 zealous hours once every 6 weeks. A little bit every day is important, and that can kind of sow seeds to start to allow you to really start to engage your whole life as practice.
So I think I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, on the one hand, you're recommending that people not beat themselves up for not doing a perfect job of meditation as they conceive of it. On the other hand, you are saying, be compassionate with yourself, but also commit. Be serious to yourself. So what is the you that you are committing to? Because here we are talking about this kind of monkey mind with all of these distractions that we have, and you're talking about unhooking, and you're talking about committing to a certain amount of time. So there seem to be many different yous implied in a lot of what you're saying. Which part of you, or which collection of you, is meditation striving to strengthen?
So there's a line in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets that he says, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. There's a line in Walt Whitman where he says, I am vast, I contain multitudes. And you are pointing to something real, but it's easy for those kind of philosophical questions to sidetrack us from the real business. Spiritual practice is something real. This path is something real. And you know in your heart that skillfully encountering a moment so that you cause more or less harm, more or less suffering, it's not actually the same. And you know that. And so allying yourself with that reality is the place to start as we move down this path of spiritual practice.
Well, I'm really glad you touched on that, because you're talking about not only how we treat ourselves and not only how we behave, but how we behave towards others and even our ability to react in a compassionate way or improve, perhaps, the lives of others. And there was a beautiful quote in here that I wanted to ask you about. This is a Dalai Lama quote, and that's actually connected to two things. So first, he says in your book, let us not talk of karma, but simply of our responsibility toward the whole world. And recently, the Dalai Lama was part of a panel with four Western scientists called Seeds of Compassion. And at the end, in the final part, it's a 2-hour program, he turned to the four scientists and he said, it is up to you in science to develop a secular value system that can promote more compassion in the world. It would be great if you could help explain the connection between this self-directed, inward-focused, maybe world-quieting practice, and this ability that you talk about also to interact with others in a different way when we come out of that practice.
Sure. Well, I mean, you've said 80% of it right there. So it's this practice of turning inward is the very thing that enables us to face outward with compassion. that enables us to respond skillfully and compassionately to the to not just ourselves, but all beings in the world.
So how are we connected to all beings in the world if we have our own minds and our thought pattern is perhaps so different from other people's?
Part of what we see through this practice is that the division between what causes suffering in us and causes suffering in the world and the place that suffering is experienced with the thing we think of as us or the thing we think of as the world, that those are not actually as cut and dry as we imagine they are. But you do not need to have you read two books on Buddhism and you've heard the word oneness and it's all one and some perspective from the absolute. And the absolute is true and real and a valid perspective. And also there's the perspective of the relative. And we tend to prefer the relative over the absolute, or some people tend to prefer the absolute over the relative. And in either case, meditation can be a way to kind of strengthen our own preferences. But with genuine practice, especially under the guidance of a teacher skilled in it, we start to see that we don't need to pick one of those perspectives over the other. We can let both contradictory perspectives function in their own spheres and be true and valid and useful and liberating in the service of ourselves and others.
So are you talking about using the practice in order to be more authentic, with the idea being that being more authentic to yourself kind of spreads, it's kind of contagious to others?
I think that is kind of a cool way of thinking about it. And I wouldn't necessarily discourage you from thinking about it like that. But also, there's a way... So all of these questions are coming from a premise, an underlying certainty that you're really sure who this self is and who this others is. And part of what Zen practice especially does is invite us to examine even that certainty. And when we do, we see that it's not quite what we thought it was.
So opening ourselves to uncertainty as well.
That's right. And Zen practice and insight or prajna or wisdom or whatever it is that the word of the day is, isn't actually about knowing more and more and having a more and more refined and perfect perception, but actually about seeing clearly the limitations of all and any knowing, about seeing the ways in which our thoughts are always clouded by our history, our conditioning, our genetics, our circumstances, and to be able to encounter to encounter our lives from a position of humility and not knowing is actually a rich part of the spiritual practice. And in fact, any form of certainty, especially righteous certainty that I'm right and you're wrong, is the functioning of the mind of delusion. Anytime we're completely sure we're right, we've bought into, we've gotten trapped in the little narrow view world of one of our own thoughts. One of my teacher's favorite bumper stickers says, don't believe everything you think.
This is really interesting because Daniel Siegel, who's written a great book about mindfulness. He came to it very late as a psychologist, a child psychologist, a parenting specialist, and ultimately a brain scientist. He's written a book, he's co-director of the UCLA Mindfulness Awareness Center, and he's written a book recently called The Mindful Brain. And he's looking at the prefrontal cortex, and he said he uses the example of a flower, very appropriate for Buddhism, and how with top-down thinking, we look at the flower, and we think of everything that we know about flowers and everything we've experienced about flowers, and that's certainly one way of experiencing the flower. But then he also talks about bottom-up experience of the flower, in which we come to the flower with as few preconceptions as possible and just experience it and look at the raggedness of that particular petal and the fact that this flower doesn't seem to have a smell, and that's fine, and just accepting it as a flower. Is that a little bit along the lines of what you're talking about?
On the one hand, sure. And, you know, I have great admiration for Dan Siegel and the work that he's done. And I don't want to buy completely into that that clear certainty that there's a top-down thing and there's a bottom-up thing. Mm-hmm. And top-down, not good. Bottom-up, very good.
Mm-hmm. So it's another trap.
That there's a way that even that kind of thing can be another trap. Mm-hmm. But with regard to questions about science or even philosophy and Buddhism, the teachings of Buddhism collectively are called the Dharma, and you know, the stuff isn't true because it's the Dharma. It's the Dharma because it's true. It's what you actually find when you look. It's what any of us in any religious tradition, in an important way, or no religious tradition, or philosophical tradition, or scientific tradition, when we really look closely at what's going on, we see this thing. And so I am continually unsurprised to hear that science in some way or other has validated some part of the thing. And I actually don't have an enormous interest in that. Although that is my academic background.
Right,
also.
You studied that in Vassar.
That's right, cognitive science.
Right. You don't need science's approval to verify what you've already found to be true in your practice? Is that it?
Well, science is one way of understanding, and I'm not looking, there's a way that we don't need to look for the scientific imprimatur, seal of approval, to validate what we're doing. And nor do we need to look for the religious seal of approval. This is a practice about finding what is useful to us in our actual lives, in our experience of what creates more suffering or what diminishes suffering or causes, enables us to move more freely amid it. And all of that is stuff that we can see directly for ourselves in our own experience.
So we can be part of creating our own Dharma.
And it's not ours. It's not the Buddha's, but it's also not ours. We are part of this one entity that is the universe.
So I wanted to go for a minute to a book that was so powerful for me, and I've read an interview powerful for you, Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. For me as I don't remember, 13 or 14 when I read that book, it was mind-blowingly simple for something that I had believed to be so incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. You know, Buddhism came to me through my grandmother and all these sculptures and all these different temples and all these gods, and you had to know all of them and all these different practices. And yet, the way Hess wrote it was of a man seeking, a man searching, and trying every ascetic practice of his day and finding them falling short to the extent that he had to discover another mm-hmm. way. So I'm just interested what you think we ordinary people can take from the example of Buddha.
Well, the Buddha was an ordinary person too. The Buddha was not a special class of being. And it isn't something that... This isn't a path that requires special abilities or special insight or some level of smartness or some level of not craziness that we somehow got escaped from our childhood with. You know, with our parents just as they are, with our mind just as it is, with our body just as it is, we can discover exactly the same thing of as what the person, the plain old guy who we now know as the Buddha, we can discover the same as what he discovered. So,
does that mean deifying him, you know, raising him up to a supernatural level is another trap that puts a barrier between us and the teachings?
Well, it can be, and in the Zen tradition, it is sometimes regarded that way. In other traditions of Buddhism, that can also be skillfully used as a tool. So, like in Vajrayana Buddhism, but that is not my path or my practice. But part of what the Buddha described himself as doing is he kind of cut his way with a machete through the thick undergrowth, blazing a path, and then he walked back and forth on that path over and over to make it really clear and smooth and easy for us to follow. And so he did the difficult work that would have been difficult for anybody of blazing a path when there was none. But now, because of the Buddha's work and because of 2.5 millennia of other people doing this work and learning about this path and refining its tools, there is whole traditions to support us in walking that very same path that the Buddha blazed for us.
And for you, and this may be a bit of a trick question, but since you use the metaphor of the path, where does the path go?
So, in some sense, it's a big circle, and it comes back to right here. And there is a sense in which any step out is a step away. Following that circle, that begins with us wanting to take up some spiritual tradition, follow a spiritual path, because we have some sense that it will help, that it will contribute something to us. So following that, and then going out, and then encountering what we encounter, which is just our own selves, and then moving past that, then when we return back to this place we never left and originally started from, we can encounter it with more flexibility, more openness, more choicefulness, and more kindness towards both ourself and others.
Well, I hear your students gathering, and we're going to let you go, but the final question, and first of all, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Well, this has just been an absolute hoot.
So if we're looking at all of the different choices that my listeners have at the buffet of culture and the way that they spend their time, is there a way that you can make a brief pitch? I'd just be interested in what you would advocate meditation or mindfulness for in terms of what its unique... You've spoken so beautifully and so eloquently about all of the benefits. I'm just wondering what is your usual cocktail party hook for people when they ask why meditate?
So in a really important way, I think that there should be a sign over every meditation hall that says, run if you can. If there's anything else that's going to work for you, by all means, please do that. But if that fails, if everything fails, and you find that wherever you go, you find sickness, old age, death, loss, change, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness. There is a practice that addresses exactly that human experience. So,
beautiful. Oh, Julie said, Josh, thank you so much. I'll be putting up a link for everybody to Josh's books, a link to his webpage, and to the fascinating photographs that he's posted online, which I really find interesting. So thank you so much for your time, Josh, and for sharing so many interesting ideas about your practices.
Well, it's just been a great pleasure, Pat.
Thank you.